The Bible and Modern Science with your host, Dr. Joseph Henson of the Science Faculty of Bob Jones University. Here is Dr. Henson.
Thank you. On our last programs, I had taken the time to give something of my own personal testimony. It is not my intent to bore people to tears, but I thought perhaps some of you might be interested in that, and it might be of some help to you to hear the testimony of a mature Christian, mature at least in the sense of age, as to the Lord's direction and protection and provision and his faithfulness in taking care of his children in light of the what the scripture prophesies occurring. It is well to bear this in mind on occasion. I quoted, or at least made reference to, a scripture that I thought it might be well to go back and read. The reference was to the last verse of Ecclesiastes 1. We talked about a bit briefly about what the scripture prophesies is ahead for the world. And verse 18 of chapter 1 reads as follows, "For in much wisdom is much grief, and he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow." And for any person who is knowledgeable in this day, I think that those words are pertinent. We don't look ahead to the coming judgment of God on the earth with happiness, but with sorrow and grief, and yet recognize that God is a holy God, that he will not do wrong. We have gotten down to the point in our discussion of insects where we are ready to consider an order of insects that are known as the Dermaptera, or the common name for them is earwigs. Derma, of course, is a combining form that means skin, and P-T-E-R-A means wing. So the etymology of the name is skin-winged insects. Some of the earwigs are winged, some of them aren't. But those that have wings, the front wings are often leathery or parchment-like. These insects are basically nocturnal. A little unusual to find them around in the daytime, although occasionally you may. The name earwig is of some interest from the standpoint of why in the world does that insect have that name? And it came from a superstition, an urban legend, if you will, that these insects would crawl in people's ears and bite them. And there are several things wrong with that. First place, the earwigs are primarily vegetarians. It is unusual for them to be predaceous, that is, to eat other insects. Although occasionally some of them will do that. When they do feed, they are feeding on dead and decaying vegetable matter. Occasionally they may feed on living plants, although they are not threats or dangers to most living material. The characteristic by which most people would recognize these is that they have cerci, or little forceps-like structures on the back end of the earwig. Since they are vegetarians, you don't have to worry about them biting. However, if you were to pick them up, if you can imagine being picked up by a giant, unbelievably larger than yourself, and getting squeezed, what would you do? Well, that's what the earwigs do. They will attempt to pinch you with the cerci, and particularly with the larger ones, they can do that. Conceivably, the larger ones, particularly if they are somewhere other than in your fingers, where you have fairly thick skin, they could conceivably draw blood, but they're not toxic or venomous, and it simply could be treated as any opening in the skin is. Around here, I don't think I have seen an earwig much over an inch long, and most of them are considerably smaller than that. Other than the fact that they are present, they're just unusual. They are not of any particularly particularly valuable to humans, nor are they particularly enemies. They don't destroy things we want to use, and so on. They're not one of the major orders of insects, although I find them very interesting. One interesting habit is that the earwigs are one of the few insects where, when eggs are laid, they will be guarded by the female. Most insects sort of lay them and go away and don't worry about them anymore. But earwigs are not included in that group. So if you're not, if you live in the tropics particularly, I would expect you to have seen them at some point or another. And as I say, they're just interesting. They look to me, they resemble beetles quite a bit. In fact, sometimes the front wings are referred to as elytra or wing covers. But at any rate, they exist. They are an example of an obviously teleological organism. They are purposive. They are an indication of creation. They are not something which just haphazardly came into existence. I don't know that we've mentioned this before. Maybe we have. One of the evolutionary ideas about the origin of insects, way back yonder, we talked about the annelids, annelids being earthworms. The marine annelids are organisms known as polychaetes. And one of the ideas of some evolutionists is that the arthropods actually evolved from the polychaetes. Now, if you have any idea, this is our Sabella. Those of you who live around the ocean may be aware of these organisms. If you're aware of that, then the notion that insects came from them is a little bit interesting. There is a quote written by a man by the name of Colin Tudge in Throw Away Your Zoology Textbooks, which appeared in the New Scientist back in November of 73, that I thought might be interesting and pertinent in this area. Where did all the arthropods come from? If they are the most numerous of all organisms, they must have had a precursor. And it is my personal opinion that the polychaetes are a little unlikely, but at least that's one possibility. In any case, let's look at the quote. Once there were the arthropoda, an extraordinarily successful phylum of joint-footed invertebrates, for example, Onychophora, trilobites, crustaceans, myriapods, arachnids, insects. They were varied, these creatures. Indeed, there were more species of arthropods than of all other kinds of animals put together. And we made that point when we were introducing arthropoda. In fact, there are more species of arthropods than there are all the other living things. So for that reason alone, they are worth having some information about them. Now back to the quote. They were nature's most supreme demonstrations of adaptive radiation about a common theme. I have immense difficulties with that sentence in two respects. Number one is this amorphous nature, that somehow this entity, quote, nature, end quote, is responsible for all of the organisms that we see. Now, if you are of a curious bent and you try and find out, okay, fine, what is this nature that's being talked about? It really just a mental construct. We talk here, people referring, I think frivolously in many cases, to Mother Nature doing this, that, or the other with regard to hurricanes or something else. I've made the comment before that if a person rejects God as creator, then that creator God has to be replaced with something else, some other entity. It may be a cosmic mind. It may be Mother Nature. It may be natural selection, whatever. And the reason for that is not too difficult to come by. If you do not have some direction given to the evolutionary process all it results in is degeneration and randomness and chaos. And if a person rejects God as creator, then they have to choose something else like nature. Now, the other thing in this sentence that bothers me, let me read the sentence again. They were nature's most supreme demonstration of adaptive radiation about a common theme. You pick up any biology book currently in print, and you're not going to read far in it before you run across the term adaptation. The idea that an organism in a particular environment, if put into a different environment, has the ability to adapt itself to that new environment. That idea is quite true. There will be changes, structural changes, visible changes to the organisms in some respects. But it's important to understand that the phenomena which are active in adaptation are phenomena that are going to affect only somatic tissue, that is, body tissue. Any complicated organism is made up of two types of tissue, reproductive and somatic. And somatic, of course, in humans would be bones, muscles, nerves, blood, etc. Reproductive tissue would be ovaries, testes, the cells themselves, be sperm or egg. Now, the organism itself is going to be exposed to those things that will affect external, that will affect only the somatic tissue itself, and they can do that. We've talked about this on more than one occasion. You can have birds that change pigmentation and snowshoe rabbits that take on white fur in the winter and so on. All of those occur, but they are changes which are going to affect only somatic tissue. And as we've talked about a number of times, if a characteristic is going to be passed on from one organism to another, there have to be changes in the genetic material. And it is important to note in passing that these changes have to occur prior to the appearance of the structure itself or the change itself. And the consequence of this is that that adaptation, the environmental phenomena, cannot bring about changes that will be passed on from parent to offspring.
Thank you, Dr. Henson. You may send email to Dr. Henson at jhenson@bju.edu. That's jhenson at bju.edu. Or write to Dr. Joseph L. Henson, Box 34621, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, zip code 29614, in the United States of America. You're invited to listen next time for The Bible and Modern Science.